You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning on Too Jewish are Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa about their book, The Counterfeit Countess, the Jewish woman who rescued thousands of Poles during the Holocaust. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Apparently, May is Jewish Heritage Month in America, something I didn't know until I read it last week. This commemoration has been around since 2006, 18 years, very Jewish, when it was started as a way to celebrate the 350th anniversary of American Judaism. It was actually initiated by the Jewish Museum of South Florida, proclaimed by the U.S. Congress in 2005 and again 2006, and then signed into law by then-President George W. Bush in 2006. This time around, 2024, President Joe Biden spoke of the immeasurable impact of Jewish values, contributions, and culture on our nation's character, and recommitting to realizing the promise of America for all Jewish Americans. I think I would be more excited about this American Jewish Heritage Month if things had gone better for us Jews over the past 7 months, and if Arab-funded pro-Palestinian terrorist protests weren't being sponsored on so many college campuses right now. Let's be clear. While some people have falsely drawn a parallel to the American peace movement of the 60s and early 70s, these terrorist-lauding protests, quote-unquote, on college campuses today are calling for the annihilation of the State of Israel and its 8 million citizens, and for global intifada, and for the imaginary state of Palestine, from the river to the sea. They are not advocating peace or humanitarian aid or some kind of positive coexistence. They are shouting for war and genocide and violence against the Jews. They are encouraging and championing mass murder. You know, I'd also be a little more excited about this being American Jewish Heritage Month if I hadn't looked up just how many National Heritage Months our U.S. Congress has already proclaimed. You probably were not aware of the fact that there are currently National Heritage Months for Irish Americans, Italian Americans, Greek Americans, Hispanic Americans, Filipino Americans, Asian Pacific Americans, Haitian Americans, Native Americans, and Caribbean Americans. For some reason, German Americans only merit a single day on the calendar, not a month. But since Germans are very efficient, that's probably all they'll need. For us Jews, who are messier, I think a month might not prove sufficient. Now that's in addition to Black History Month, pretty well known, and Women's History Month, also well known. Man, there are not enough months on the calendar for all of these. In fact, when you start looking at all the commemorations and holidays proclaimed by our U.S. federal government, you begin to think that the Jewish calendar's plethora of festivals isn't really so over the top. There are 46 special months recognized by presidential proclamation. 46 special months, and there's only 12 months in the year. Only the government could manage that arithmetic. And there are also 20 special weeks and 47 special days recognized by presidential proclamations. This makes the Catholic Saints' Day calendar, which has had many more centuries to evolve, seem kind of reasonable. So this month, our American Jewish Heritage Month is shared with Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, Older Americans Month, National Physical Fitness and Sports Month, National Foster Care Month, and Mental Health Awareness Month. I can certainly understand sharing Jewish American Heritage Month with Mental Health Awareness Month. After all, we Jews invented psychology. It used to be called the Jewish science. Sigmund Freud, the principal initiating force. Well, some of my favorite special periods of national time include National Financial Literacy Month. Ooh, that's exciting. National Cybersecurity Month and the ever-popular National Critical Infrastructure Protection Month. All real winners in the excitement category. But who can fail to celebrate National Dairy Goat Awareness Week with appropriate festivity? I was distressed to learn we no longer regularly celebrate another presidentially proclaimed holiday, National Catfish Day. In any case, May is indeed National Jewish American Heritage Month, and since we've been around in America for 370 years now, in an era when people think bagels are a purely American baked good and that hummus is pronounced hummus, it's worth noting that our contributions to American society are quite extensive and go well beyond the culinary. Now, the presidential proclamation proclaiming this special Jewish American Heritage Month was different this year. It acknowledged the changed and painful reality of the past 7 months since October 7th. President Biden's statement includes these passages. As we celebrate the Jewish American community's contributions this month, we also honor their resilience in the face of a long and painful history of persecution. Hamas's brutal terrorist attack on October 7th against Israel marked the deadliest day for Jews since the Holocaust, resurfacing, including here in the United States, painful scars from millennia of anti-Semitism and genocide of Jewish people. Jews across the country and around the world are still coping with the trauma and horror of that day and the months since. Our hearts are with all the victims, survivors, families, and friends whose loved ones were killed, wounded, displaced, or taken hostage, including women and girls whom Hamas subjected to appalling acts of rape and sexual violence. As I said after Hamas's terror attack, this is from President Biden, my commitment to the safety of the Jewish people, the security of Israel, and its right to exist as an independent Jewish state is ironclad. The recent attack by Iran, firing a barrage of hundreds of missiles and drones at Israel, reminds us of the existential threats Israel faces by adversaries that want nothing less than to wipe it off the map. Together with our allies and partners, the U.S. defended Israel, and we helped defeat this attack. Here at home, too many Jews live with deep pain and fear from the ferocious surge of anti-Semitism in our communities, at schools, places of worship, in colleges, and across social media. These acts are despicable and echo the worst chapters of human history. They remind us hate never goes away, it only hides until it is given oxygen. It is our shared moral responsibility to forcefully stand up to anti-Semitism and to make clear that hate can have no safe harbor in America. That is why I released the first ever United States National Strategy to Counter Anti-Semitism, says the president, and clarified the civil rights protections for Jews under Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In addition, the Department of Education has launched investigations into anti-Semitism on college campuses. The Department of Justice is investigating and prosecuting hate crimes. The Department of Homeland Security and the Federal Bureau of Investigation are focusing on enhancing security in Jewish communities. We also secured the largest increase in funding ever for the physical security of nonprofits like synagogues, Jewish community centers, and Jewish schools. I, says the president, appointed Deborah Lipstadt, a Holocaust expert, as the first ever ambassador-level special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism. Together, we're sending the message that in America, evil will not win. Hate will not prevail. The venom and violence of anti-Semitism will not be the story of our time. Good words from President Joe Biden. Now, let's see if they continue to be backed by actions, including continuing to supply Israel the weapons it needs to defeat the brutal Palestinian terrorists of Hamas. To play us in this morning, here's an antique classic about Passover on the Range. Just discovered this. It was written by Mo Jaffe and Henry Tobias and recorded by Bernie Nee long ago.
In the land of the purple sage, where the Lone Ranger is all the rage, every year without fail, I return to the trail, and I'll do it till I die of old age. I'm heading for the prairie where the laws are dietary, 'cause it's Passover time out on the range, where a cowhand never joshes when he's singing the fear cautious, and cedar is held around a campfire for a change. Give me lots of yippee-yi-yi, lots of matzah, yippee-yi-yi. Let me eat until I've had my fill and get a stomach ache. Drink l'chaim, yippee-yi-yi, with cactus wine, yippee-yi-yi. Even if we stuff, there's not enough. Get them to rattlesnake. I'm heading for the prairie where the laws are dietary, 'cause it's Passover time out on the range, where bar mitzvah's a saloon that serves a beer with macaroon, and eggs are laid hard by kosher chicks, and no one thinks it's strange. Give me lots of yippee-yi-yi, lots of matzah, yippee-yi-yi. Loaded with gehackte buffalo, it's there for one and all. Drink l'chaim, yippee-yi-yi, with cactus wine, yippee-yi-yi. Then you'll start to dance to an old square dance at the Pesach Matzah Bowl.
That was Passover on the Range for Jewish American Heritage Month this May. By the way, the lyricist of that classic song, Mo Jaffe, was a Tin Pan Alley songsmith. He graduated from Wharton and Penn's Law School and then wrote classic songs like Gypsy in My Soul and the immortal I'm My Own Grandpa. So there. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guests, Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa, tell us the remarkable origins of their book, The Counterfeit Countess, the Jewish woman who rescued thousands of Poles during the Holocaust. It's an incredible story. Hear about it and how the book came to life when we come back in just a moment here on Two Jewish. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guests this morning, Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa. They are the co-authors of a new book, The Counterfeit Countess, which is about the Jewish woman who rescued thousands of Poles during the Holocaust, pretending to be a Polish countess. It's an amazing true story. Barry White recently retired from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. She was historian and research director for their Center for the Prevention of Genocide. She spent a career at the U.S. Department of Justice investigating and prosecuting Nazi criminals and human rights violators. Joanna Sliwa is a historian at the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany in New York and has had a number of other distinguished positions. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish, both of you.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having us.
This is an amazing story, and actually the way it came to print is also rather astonishing. A true story about a woman who pretended to be something very different than she was, saved thousands of lives in some of the worst conditions in Lvov and in Majdanek, and then didn't write her story till the 60s. It got sent to some academics, and then eventually kind of found its way to you. Barry, tell us a little bit about the story of this story.
Yes, this goes all the way back to 1989 when I gave an academic conference paper on Majdanek concentration camps. The SS established this camp in German-occupied Lublin, Poland during World War II. And after the panel, a historian I didn't know handed me the carbon copy of the memoir of this Polish-Jewish mathematician, Janina Mailberg. The memoir describes how she survived the Holocaust in German-occupied Poland using the false identity of the Countess Sukadolska, a Polish Christian aristocrat. She used this identity to become an official of a Polish relief organization for which she negotiated face-to-face with Nazi and SS officials. The memoir made it sound like she was stubbornly persistent in her negotiations and surprisingly successful. at Majdanek, she got the SS to let her organization deliver massive quantities of food for thousands of prisoners. Didn't happen at any other concentration camp. And she brought these deliveries herself inside the camp, a place where the SS murdered 63,000 Jews in gas chambers and shooting pits. And she used the deliveries as cover to smuggle messages and supplies to members of the resistance in the camp, because she was also an officer in the underground Polish Home Army. So I was so astonished by this.
It's an unbelievable story. You know, no wonder you were skeptical at first, right?
Yes, yeah. I couldn't use it without first verifying it, and I didn't have a way to do that. She died in Chicago in 1969. There were no living relatives I could interview. I couldn't go to Poland to do research, especially since I don't know Polish. So I kept hoping that another historian would find the memoir in the archives and write about it. But that didn't happen, and it really haunted me. So in 2018, I sent the memoir to Joanna, whom I only knew by reputation as an expert on the Holocaust in Poland.
And that's when the research began. And not only did you corroborate the manuscript, but you found much more and even more astonishing facts about this extraordinary Jewish woman, the so-called Countess, and what she did. We will talk much more about that with our guests about the book, The Counterfeit Countess, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services, 6:30 p.m. every Friday night, 10 a.m. Saturday mornings, or attend on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person and online. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school is available to sign up for school-age children and grandchildren. Our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with fabulous Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up for the 5785 school year. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night, Saturday morning, Friday night at 6:30 p.m. in person or on our Facebook page. Shabbat morning, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. Shabbat services and Torah reading, at all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. You can also come on Facebook. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our musical services are available in person and virtually, and all of our Adult Education Academy classes are offered live and on Zoom, all of them through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Go and sign up. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation coming up soon, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish congregation community in all of southern Arizona. If you've got a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or kvel, email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at Gmail. Or go to our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store, is very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America. According to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to our podcasts. All of those comments help.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So last week we were speaking about your recent visit to France, and you managed to get into this famous synagogue in Carpentras, which is one of the really, it was actually quite an important Jewish community in the south of France, Provence. Carpentras Synagogue goes back to, I want to say the 13th century, might even be earlier than that.
At least the 13th century. And it is the oldest synagogue in France that still functions as a synagogue.
And one of the oldest of the world, actually, that still functions as a synagogue, although not the oldest. So tell us a little bit about it, because I've seen occasional pictures. I know some of the music of the Jews of Carpentras, because it's significant Sephardic Jewish community.
So first of all, the synagogue is in the heart of town. It's right, it's adjacent to the big market square where all the activity took place, because Jews were merchants. They participated in the mercantile life of the city. At one point, there was a ghetto there where the space allocated to the Jewish community was so small that they built houses as high as 10 stories. There is no building today in Carpentras that's more than two or three stories. I mean, it's funny to think that back in the 13th or 14th or 15th century, they might have had 10-story buildings there with obviously no elevator or anything.
Right, that's so a walk-up.
It was a hardship.
Yeah.
But the synagogue is extensive. Like many synagogues in that part of the world, it includes a communal oven for cholent, for the Sabbath.
For Shabbat food,
right,
and stuff.
Right? And a matzah oven.
Right, a separate one.
Community baking matzah.
So you could make your Pesach food,
right,
there.
And a mikveh, which is attached to a flowing river, like a live river flows through.
So it's real Mayim Chaim, real,
right,
living water.
Right. It's not our pathetic excuse for a mikveh. And this stuff, you know, it all reeks of antiquity. The actual sanctuary looks pretty modern. It does not look like a museum piece. And there are brass plates with engraved names on the seats. So that feels very modern.
That's pretty contemporary.
Right.
Yeah.
But the tour was extremely interesting because I think that the tour guide was probably the only other Jew there besides me. And what I was surprised at was this is way before the tourist season.
I think off mic that there's like 50 people on this tour or something. I mean, it's quite large.
Yeah, there were at least 50, maybe 60. I was surprised by the size of the crowd because A, this is before the tourist season. B, this was Monday afternoon, like in the middle of the day from 2 p.m. to roughly 3:30 or 4 maybe. And you have to reserve in advance and you have to pay and it's like a little bit of a hassle. So you have to really want to be there. They did take some walk-ins, which they never did before, but you know, maybe because it was the only tour that day and they couldn't say come back later, whatever. So the composition of the group was very interesting to me because Americans often think of France as a very anti-Semitic country, but the vast majority of people in this tour group were French people who were interested in the history of the synagogue And they ask questions about certain Jewish practices, like reading the Torah and observing Shabbat and what the function of a mikveh was and all, you know, all those things. They show genuine and respectful curiosity, not a shred of hostility. There were a few foreigners. I think there were four Americans, other than me, who had a French-speaking guide with them who did a very good job and has obviously been in that synagogue many times before. She could have done the guided tour, but they were the only people who needed English, apparently. And the others might have included Belgians and Swiss and maybe some Germans, but they all were comfortable in French. And the tour was very detailed and people followed carefully and showed no signs of impatience. And it was a wonderful experience because I'd been so frustrated over the years by not being able to get into this particular synagogue yeah, that was yeah. pretty near where I lived.
Well, I'm glad you finally made it. And if people are going to be in France sometime soon in Provence, do make reservations online in advance. Probably have someone with you who can speak French also.
Right.
Tom, thanks so much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Arnold is 29 years old and still living at home. He comes down to breakfast one morning after a big night out. As soon as he sits down, he says to his parents, "Mom, Dad, you'll be pleased to hear. I met an amazing girl last night. I was so captivated by her beauty and charm. By the end of the evening, I could see the two of us marrying under the chuppah. I finally found somebody. What do you think?" His dad replies, "Arnold, it sounds like something good is happening with you at last. But it's important for you to marry somebody who has the same belief as the family." "But Dad," says Arnold, "why do I want to marry a girl who thinks I'm a schmuck?" That was the old Jewish Joke of the Week special, feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well, and don't be a schmuck. And now a word of Torah. Emor, our portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do. God commands the people of Israel. But the language this time is different. Usually, commandments begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel. Occasionally, it's tzav, command the children of Israel. This time, the much softer word in Hebrew, emor, say to the priest, the children of Aaron, is used. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of this portion. The Seder actually begins, "say to the priests," and then adds, "and say to them." The commentators do not believe the Torah is ever truly redundant. The Talmud teaches that there is a subtle message here. Be cautious in how we as adults speak to children. Emor means speak softly, kindly. Well, that's good advice in instructing children anytime. Why is this word emor used twice in regard to commanding the priests? These priests are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness that was given to our ancestors and articulated forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kiddushim. You shall all be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in Emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to softer forms of language is notable. The priests are the ones who actually have to help the people achieve holiness. They must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements for the religious ceremonies, but they also must be inspired to do that work with devotion and passion. There is a balance to maintain between conscientious, obsessive attention to detail and finding a way to communicate the sacredness of their calling to the Jewish people, who are not as occupied with processes and may not be as emotionally invested in them as the priests themselves are. Thus, the word used here is emor, speak, explain, teach, inspire, not daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading anyone to holiness, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality. Badly performed rituals inspire no one. There must also be a demonstrated process of caring, caring about the way those processes are experienced by the devotees, even perhaps especially a love for both the process and the results. This week of M.O.R., may we be inspired to seriously and caringly seek holiness in our lives through our Jewish practice. May we seek to inspire others to do so as well. When we return in a moment, our guests, Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa, tell us how this incredible story of rescue during the Shoah, of a daring Jewish woman who pretended to be what she was certainly not, and saved many lives, became their book, The Counterfeit Countess, Jewish Woman Who Rescued Thousands of Poles During the Holocaust. Hear the dramatic tale of this forgotten heroine, how she did so much, when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Pro-Palestinian terrorist protests on college campuses wound down last week. Graduations were canceled at some universities, and students and their many non-student professional protesters left for summer activities. And the news focus shifted to Washington. As Israel prepared to launch a major operation in Rafah, going ahead over the concerns of the White House, the Biden administration made rare use of a pressure tactic and held up the delivery of 3,500 large bombs. We are currently reviewing some near-term security assistance equipment in the context of unfolding events in Rafah. As we have assessed the situation, we paused one shipment of high-payload munitions, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said during Senate testimony last week. Secretary Austin's comments came less than 2 days after Israel announced it began its invasion of Rafah, the southern Gaza city that the Biden administration has urged Israel not to invade. President Joe Biden said the consequences could grow steeper for Israel. If they go into Rafah, I'm not supplying the weapons that have been used historically to deal with Rafah, to deal with cities, he said. He said he did not consider Israel's operations so far in Rafah to cross the line, but it was right on the border because of its proximity to dense population centers. Biden said the U.S. would continue to aid Israel with defensive needs, including the Iron Dome missile defense system. We're not walking away from Israel's security, Biden said. We're walking away from Israel's ability to wage war in those areas, meaning Rafah. Biden's comments and the U.S. pause, whatever that means, in aid to Israel, the first time in four decades that has happened, mark a dramatic shift in the Biden administration's posture towards the war in Gaza. In the 7 months since Hamas attacked Israel brutally, Biden has steadfastly supported Israel, including in a speech at the U.S. Capitol just last week, and previously resisted ending or conditioning American military aid. But Biden has been under large pressure from progressives within and outside of his party to suspend assistance to Israel as the Palestinian casualties mount. Austin was reminded of those pressures during his testimony when protesters shouting "Free Palestine," whatever that is, were removed from the gallery. Biden has previously said Israel's bombing of Gaza, which reduced large parts of the enclave to rubble, has been indiscriminate. Israel says the bombs are necessary to reach an enemy that has constructed a massive military infrastructure in an underground network of tunnels half the size of the New York subway system. The announcement of the pause in the delivery of large bombs set off alarms among pro-Israel organizations. Delaying this arms transfer is a dangerous and counterproductive message, AIPAC said. It emboldens Iran, Hamas, and Hezbollah and undermines America's commitment to its allies. Congress must demand the Biden administration reverse this delay and ensure Israel has what it needs to win this war. The holdup last week came as Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu indicated the IDF will invade Rafah, which Israel says is the final redoubt of Hamas. Well, it is. The invasion started last week after another attempt at a ceasefire agreement fell through. Hamas accepted that Israel would release Palestinian terrorist murderers, but it had not accepted the part about releasing Israeli hostages and the bodies of dead Israeli and American hostages it has ghoulishly held after murdering them. Biden and other world leaders have opposed the invasion because more than a million displaced Palestinians have sought refuge in densely populated Rafah. The U.S. position has been Israel should not launch a major ground operation in Rafah, where more than a million people are sheltering with nowhere else to go. A senior White House official said, "We've been engaging in a dialogue with Israel and our strategic consultative group on how they will meet the humanitarian needs of civilians in Rafah and how to operate differently against Hamas there than they have elsewhere in Gaza." In his Senate testimony, Austin said the safety of the civilians was paramount. "I think we've been very clear about the steps we'd like to see Israel take to account for and take care of those civilians before major combat takes place." The statements by Austin and the unnamed official appear to confirm reports the meetings with Bibi Netanyahu's representatives have not gone well because, in the administration's view, Israel has not adequately explained how it plans to safely evacuate or house displaced Palestinians. Not sure why that's Israel's responsibility, but there it is. "Those discussions are ongoing and have not fully addressed our concerns," the U.S. official said. The confirmation of the pause came a day after the president, in his Holocaust Remembrance Day speech, as we quoted earlier, reaffirmed what he called his ironclad commitment to Israel. The White House official emphasized that the $26 billion that Congress allocated last month in emergency and humanitarian assistance to Israel and Gaza is untouched. "We are committed to ensuring Israel gets every dollar appropriated in the supplemental package," the official said. Now, Biden administration officials are watching the Rafah operation unfold and expressing cautious optimism that Israel appears to be limiting its attacks to minimize civilian casualties. "We're going to watch closely, but how they have described this is not of a size, scale, duration, and scope that one could equate to a major ground operation," said John Kirby, the National Security Council spokesman. The weapons holdup is the first confirmed on-the-record pause of U.S. defense assistance to Israel since 1983, when then-President Ronald Reagan delayed the delivery of combat aircraft to Israel to pressure Israel to withdraw from Lebanon. Another oft-cited pause in the delivery of Hellfire missiles during the last major war in Gaza in 2014, 10 years ago, was later said to be a technical issue, not a policy choice. The shipment that was paused included 1,800 bombs weighing 2,000 pounds each and 1,700 bombs weighing 500 pounds. The officials said the White House began reviewing weapons shipments last month, said the delivery of devices that add guidance to bombs is also under review. "We are especially focused on the end use of the 2,000-pound bombs and the impact they could have in dense urban settings, as we have seen in other parts of Gaza." The American Jewish Committee, like AIPAC, called for ending the pause supplying bombs to Israel while also thanking Biden for supporting Israel since October 7th. The AJC is grateful the unprecedented security assistance the U.S. administration has surged to Israel as it defends itself against Hamas terrorists and for the ongoing close collaboration between U.S. and Israeli officials, said the American Jewish Committee's spokesman. "This support must continue without any additional conditions or delays so Israel can defend itself from multiple attacks it faces and prevent Hamas's stated goal of continued repeated attacks. We expect the administration to swiftly ensure all necessary assistance is delivered." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guests this morning, Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa. They are the co-authors of the book, The Counterfeit Countess, The Jewish Woman Who Rescued Thousands of Poles During the Holocaust, which came from a manuscript that had a kind of a complicated journey, as we spoke about earlier in the show. So this woman who becomes this dramatic Countess Janina Suchodolska has a number of identities. Once you began to dig into it, Joanna, tell us a little bit about, like, who was she? How did she become who she became?
Janina Suchodolska, that was her false name during the Holocaust, was really a master of reinvention and of deception. And she also had, as we discovered in our genealogical and archival research, she had quite a remarkable life before World War II and after World War II. So she was born as Pepi Spinner in Eastern Galicia, which today is the areas of Ukraine, and before World War II used to be Poland. She was born in 1905 to a wealthy family. She was very well educated, knew several languages. And in fact, Pepi Spinner was a mathematical genius, and she received her master's degree in mathematics, but she couldn't receive her doctorate in that discipline as a woman, as a Jew. And so she pursued her doctorate in philosophy, where she studied under this charismatic professor who instilled patriotic values in his students. And it was at the university that Pepi, at the time, met her husband, future husband, Henry Melberg. And so afterwards, of course, she became Pepi Melberg. But because of all the reinventions of her first name, of her last name, Barry and I chose to call her Janina throughout the book. Because no matter if it was, you know, during the war, of course, but also after the war, Janina retained her name. It was very important to her to retain that name, Janina, throughout her life. So that's why we call her Janina.
So she took this identity. She and her husband had help from non-Jewish Poles, which is a fascinating and complicated story, the role of Poles in both the survival and sometimes the destruction of Jews during the Holocaust. She became an important figure in the Polish resistance, actually, and somehow managed to face down Gestapo, SS, kind of the worst of the German authorities, the concentration camp directors, and get people desperately needed supplies, both Christian Poles and Jews. Tell us a little bit about how she did it.
So she was became an official of an organization, the RGO, which the Nazis allowed to help only Polish, non-Jewish Poles. They could not help Jews. And so she was not in a position actually to be as a Jew in hiding, basically, pretending to be a Christian Pole. She had no way that she could help the Jews in Lublin, who were among the first to be murdered in the Holocaust. So she decided to concentrate her energies where she could do the most good and save the most lives and be most effective in resisting her country's occupiers. So as an official of this organization, because she had perfect German, she was the one who negotiated with German Nazi and SS officials for measures to aid Poles. And she was very adept at framing her requests, not as requests, but as measures that were obviously in the Germans' interest. And so they would be silly not to accept them. So, for example, at Majdanek, which had by far the highest mortality rate of all the concentration camps, including Auschwitz, she was able to present herself to the commandant as his ally in the effort to keep his prisoners healthier longer so that they would be able to work longer. If they had adequate food and medicines, then they would be able to work longer. And so that was in his interest, and she could make that happen.
It's an extraordinary tale. You see this in movies, and you find it hard to believe. So here she was smuggling in, I guess, prepared soups, Christmas stuff, all kinds of things, right under the noses. I mean, literally with the basically the cooperation of the Nazis. Was she in danger of being revealed really on a constant basis, Barry?
Yes. Every time she went into Majdanek, she risked being tortured and executed if they discovered either that she was smuggling supplies into the camp under the cover of these deliveries or that she was a Jew. Because she was bringing in such massive quantities of food, she was able to get permission to take it right into the camp to each of the prisoner compounds, which then gave her access for smuggling. And so, for example, she had the soup cans that fitted with false bottoms so that she could smuggle messages and, at one point, even weapons into the camp.
She smuggled weapons in? I must have missed that in the book. Like...
Yes, as part of the plot for a breakout from a evacuation transport, she smuggled in razor blades and spiked liquor and wire cutters.
And was she responsible for any of the prisoner escapes?
We do know that there was an escape from one of the evacuation trains, and it happened right after she delivered those supplies. So we don't know for sure that they were the ones who used the weapon.
You guys are serious researchers, so I don't want to have you make grand conclusions. In the course of the research that went into this remarkable book, and by the way, it reads like a spy novel. I mean, it's, and I say that in a positive way, it's just a very engaging read, which, to be honest, some of the Holocaust memoirs really aren't. When you were exploring this, Joanna, you as a historian, and Barry, you've done a lot of research into finding Nazi war criminals. Did you encounter people that you had dealt with that you knew about through your other work in terms of both survivors and the Nazi criminals?
Well, yes. One of the most surprising things that I discovered was that she was able to negotiate the release of over 2,000 peasants from who'd been dumped in Majdanek in the summer of 1943. These were mostly children and the elderly. And the SS officials that she negotiated to get them released was the manager of Operation Reinhardt, the largest murder operation of the Holocaust.
Well, I think for me, the more interesting part was encountering names that I did not know before and learning about the activities of those people. For example, you know, earlier on, Rabbi Cohen, you mentioned the Count Andrei Chinsky, the one who rescued the Melbergs from Lvov and basically smuggled them on a train to Lublin. And he was the one, Count Chinsky, was the one who gave the Melbergs the false identities of Countess Yanina and Count Piotr Suchodolsky. And Count Chinsky, a real count, he was an important figure in the Polish Main Welfare Council, this relief organization. And his story is extraordinary. And what he did to bring help to the Polish people in the Lublin district and to help Janina and Henry survive, of course. But the interesting part to me was that his relatives did not even know what he did during the war. And so when I spoke with his granddaughter, it was news to her that her grandfather was indeed a rescuer of a Jewish couple.
Now there's a political reason for some of this, and it's reflected in her story. She was part of an anti-communist resistance group when the communists came in and took over after the Soviet Union took over that part of Poland. You know, it wasn't probably politically wise to be identified with, even though you had saved Poles, an anti-communist group. And suddenly she became not an anti-communist and worked for as the head of a social service organization. So I wonder if that wasn't true for others who were kind of stuck after the war.
I mean, for sure, there were many factors why rescuers were not comfortable with talking about their actions during World War II, during the Holocaust, to save Jews. A lot of the time, it was because they feared their Polish neighbors and the accusations that they benefited from the rescue of Jews. Another part, of course, was that, yes, what you're saying about communism and kind of this narrative of laying low and not really talking about what you went through during the Holocaust. So actually that played a role too. And as you mentioned, yes, Yanina had another, you know, reinvention she became Dr. Yanina Suchodolska after the war, a social worker, a deputy director of a newly created relief organization for Poles. And that role allowed her to travel around Poland to witness the destruction that the Polish people sustained during the war. But she also witnessed the anti-Semitism that was pervasive at the time in Poland. Jews suffered from a lot of violence. Hundreds were killed. 100 survivors were killed after the Holocaust. And so that solidified her resolve and her husband that they had to leave Poland.
The numbers of the people she rescued, you count well over 9,000 Poles who were saved by her, but the number is probably much higher based on having brought food in and all kinds of other, you know, getting people into hospitals, really amazing work. Has she ever been honored by the Polish government? Is that something that might happen?
No, she was not honored by the Polish government. No one knew that she was, in fact, Jewish, that the wartime Yanina Suchodolska was, in fact, Yanina Melberg or Pepi Spinner years before the war. And Barry and I discovered that, and we were able to corroborate this information, find evidence for it. And even scholars, excellent scholars who researched the history of Majdanek, of Lublin during World War II, of the Holocaust as it developed in Lublin, they had no idea that Yanina Suchodolska, whom they knew the name, she was, you know, someone who was active in this main welfare council, they knew the name, but they had no idea that she was in fact Jewish. So that was completely new information.
I feel like we could go on quite a bit more. It's an extraordinary story. The book is called The Counterfeit Countess. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the book?
Well, we have a website for the book, which is www.counterfeitcountess.com. We also each have our own websites. So Joanna is joannasleva.com and mine is elizabethbwhite.com. And we are both committed to making sure that the world learns about Yanina Melberg. She really should rank among the greatest heroines of World War II. And so whether it's through reading our book or hearing about her, we want to make sure that people know of her. So if you've got an organization or a book club or whatever, and you would be interested in having us talk to you, please contact us through our website.
Thank you so much for a great visit here on Too Jewish, The Counterfeit Countess. Special thanks to our guests this morning, Elizabeth Barry White and Joanna Sliwa. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish. With me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be military expert Eric Lin, former senior advisor to the Secretary of Defense for 6 years, speaking about Israel's security and the regional threats in the Middle East from Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and elsewhere. Please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person live, and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Eden Golan. It's Israel's entry into this week's Eurovision Festival, And for Israel Independence Day, coming up this week, Yom HaAtzmaut, 76th birthday. This song is called Hurricane, and in its original version, this wonderful song reflected on October 7th. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Writer of my symphony, play with me, look into my eyes and see. People walk away but never say goodbye. Someone stole the moon tonight, took my light. Everything is black and white. Who's the fool who told you boys don't cry? Hours and hours and powers. Life is no game but it's ours while the time goes wild. Every day.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.